Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Vicini. We are presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, it's the man who brought Pete Dillon back to life this weekend after he was accidentally killed by Rex Chapman. It's Matt Penny. Yeah. What up, Ben?
Oh, I feel great. We survived six long days of basketball, which is great. I'm not complaining about it. I feel like we're breathing. We've made it to the other side here. We got a little bit of a break. We can pod, and we have survived, similar to Pete Gillen, which is great because I know Pete personally, and I hesitated when Rex Chapman said, rest in peace, Pete Gillen. I'm like, oh, shit, I missed it. This is, I feel like a bad person. Like, I was at a wedding with Pete Gillen in the fall. I didn't know he was in poor health, and apparently needed to Pete Gillen because he was over at CBS Sports recording as that was happening, as he was ceremoniously or unceremoniously buried on live TV. We all make mistakes. We all have blunders about call-outs. That's a big one to make.
I can't. I just absolutely can't. That is hysterical to me. I will say this was a long weekend of basketball for me. It was longer for me than most people because I have to wake up at 3 a.m. to watch these games. And I've got to tell you, by the time the Arizona game happened yesterday, my body was shutting down.
Well, you have it like the actual inverse because you have to wake up at like 3:30 in the morning, right? And then like what time your time to the Arizona game end?
4:30.
See, you can like so you can nap and recharge, revolve. Like when I woke up those last few games and it started off fast and furious when Rutgers Notre Dame went into St. Patrick's Day and I had to see the Mike Bray comments afterwards. He says, St. Patrick's Day, we won. I hope this Irish whiskey on the plane. I'm like holding my eyelids open. So like by the last game last night, I'm just like, please do not go to overtime. We got overtime. TCU Arizona. I'm like, great, whatever. We're here. But I feel like you chase on the front end. I was chasing on the back end. I was chasing the night.
Well, I feel like the problem is that when you chase on the front end, it ends up chasing on the back end. Like there was a time I'm trying to remember what window it was. It was the window I think on Friday where like Auburn was playing Jacksonville State and like was that window? I can't remember.
That was Friday at like two-ish, three-ish around there.
Yeah, it was the end of the like morning/afternoon window.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I have to go to sleep. This is my window. This is all one seeds except for one game. If I don't sleep now, I'm dead.
It was also great too because we kind of looked at some games. We talked about it together. We said, all right, I don't think like Baylor and North Carolina, that won't be a great one. Sleep in a little bit. And it's oof, we've made a mistake. Like that was one worth waking up for.
Yeah. And I ended up chasing it. Like the next game, basically. I can't remember what the next game was there. I don't think it was the Ohio State game. I think it was the day before that. Whatever the 5 o'clock game was, I woke up for the 5 o'clock game, the 5:30 in the morning game, which is the like second afternoon game
the witching
for
hour.
You guys. And inverse I was just hour. Like, wait a minute. What do we do here? How do we chase this right now?
You look fresh. You don't look tired. You don't look sometimes. When people are dragged out after usually long benders for other reasons, not watching basketball, you can see it, but you look rejuvenated. So I don't know if it's been these 12 hours since we've stopped playing basketball that you've gotten to a better place.
Well, if people noticed, I wrote a big write-up on the first weekend, opening weekend, on the top 10 prospects that participated, except for AJ Griffin, just because I frankly didn't have a lot of takes on AJ Griffin this weekend. But after the Arizona game ended, I'd pre-written Johnny Davis. I'd pre-written Keegan Murray, obviously, because he only played one game. I'd pre-written here and there already, but like I still had 2,500 words to write and I had to stay up and write it. And then Laura had a netball game, that I wanted to go to, at 9 o'clock at night. So I didn't get to bed until 1 o'clock. I was up at 7:30 this morning because I was texting you and our mutual friend that our group text is. So like, it was, you know, I don't know. I think that I've tried to eat healthy and not drink this weekend. That was the goal.
Well, maybe that's why you're a little bit more fresh than you would be if you chased it with bad food and bad drink, which makes you set back another day or two, which you don't need to do because we have a little bit of a break. We're bouncing right back to games in 2-3 days as it is.
And I think this, I think I decided last night that this is the last time I will not be in the United States for opening weekend.
Oh, wow.
Because I like that. It's just, I don't want to do this again. Like, I honestly didn't really enjoy, like, I didn't enjoy it as much as I should have, I felt like. Like, look, all these games were great. I had such a fun time. But, like, my ass was dragging. I was watching games at 5:30 in the morning. Like, it's just different. You know what I mean? And I think
I've made, I don't know what you mean, but I can imagine it. Because I know the early morning bell when it hits, and you really don't want to do anything. You just want to jam some caffeine into your system right away. I'm not thinking about like ball screen coverage of Lucas Williamson and Malachi Branham. I'd like to say I wake up and I'm ready to talk draft and get my takes out, but I'm not. Got to warm up the body a little bit too.
My problem is that I can't turn it off, to be honest. Like, wow. I can't turn that like analytical part of it off while watching basketball now, which is like not great, to be honest. Especially with draft prospects. Like when I'm watching college basketball, I can't turn it off. With NBA games, I can turn it off sometimes. Like if there's just a really great game happening, I'm just like, fuck, I'm going to enjoy this. Like I'm not going to sit here and try and figure out like why this corner 3-point shooter is open right now. You know, who screwed up the weak side coverage. Like I need to stop.
Well, that's how I feel when it's sort of teams that don't have these knockout draft prospects. Like I can just watch the game, relax. I don't have to take notes on my phone. I'm not putting on my laptop, but what I do admire about you, and you tweet about it pretty well, is I'll be watching a game and I get so honed in on two or three guys that I'll miss like some of the offensive coverages or what they did for ball screen defense or how they scrambled on a skip pass. I'll read yours. I'm like, I didn't even see that because I wasn't looking. I'm just like watching. I'm watching right. This guy. Like, is Kendall Brown going to do anything? I'm just watching him the whole time. And then it's like, right. Oh, well, yeah, James Akinjo, he dug down and recovered. And that's why Sohan got the thing at the top. And I got to find a way to slow down too, because we do get draft brainy here.
We do like, and I have like irreparable draft brain. I think that's the best way to put it. It's a IDB, irreparable draft brain. That's a, right, that's, that, a new that, disease.
That's a new trademark. We're writing chapters in the book along with the Malachi effect. It's nice.
That's a new t-shirt. IDB, irreparable draft brain. Okay. So we're going to talk about Chet Holmgren, Jabari Smith, all of the prospects that we saw this weekend. We're going to talk about the games too. Like, I want to talk about St. Peter's because that's a fucking cool story. Like, I tweeted this already, but just like that story to me is the epitome of like, how can you not be romantic about college basketball? Like, yeah. I don't get caught up in the pageantry of it. Like, when I worked at CBS, like I worked and talked to Matt Norlander every day. I still talk to Norlander regularly, but like I talk to Norlander every day and he gets so into like the pageantry of it all and the history and all of those things that are just cool. Right. And because I have irreparable draft brain, I don't necessarily always get caught up in that, but the St. Peter's thing, like how can you not get caught up in that? It's fucking amazing.
It's beautiful. And you see the tidal wave coming too. It's like, I'm not going to stop this. I'm going to enjoy this wave that's coming over. You're never seeing Tata Washington play again. Good luck. How's your intel? How's your eval? I'm like, whatever, man. Let Doug hit some threes and do another mustache dance. I'm like, whatever. I'm in. Let Shaheen talk his noise. Like, I'm in.
I mean, and like Shaheen's just a great personality too. Like an unbelievable person to be achieving this success and getting this platform, right? Like getting this opportunity to pitch his message. Because he's such a good messenger about like New York mindset. Like his post-game press conference after their win against Murray State, where he's like, what, you think that like these kids from New York City and New Jersey are going to be scared and the teams are going to out-tough us? We do that. That's what we do. And it's just
and that's so authentic. It's so New York, New Jersey. This isn't Brian Kelly going down to Louisiana and all of a sudden getting like a twang. Like this is Shaheen Hall. He played at Seton Hall, man. He coached at Seton Hall. He's from the area. Those are the type of kids you recruit. And somebody like made a good point about it today in the office is that like on our circuit, on Under Armour circuit, Weaver team, Riverside Hawks, that don't have like the highest of high major guys, but they made a similar run this summer because they just like got hot and out toughed people. And that's like the New York mentality and mindset. And now you get to see it on CBS Sports and primetime taking down Kentucky. And now everyone's dusting off like, hey, have you seen their gym? Like they have a cargo net in the middle of it. Like they did volleyball practice there. They, their school is a street. Somebody had a video of just like, here's their school. Yeah, but like, what'd you think? And everyone's just primed to be beat too. And you look across the field and some of the upsets, like I didn't think Iowa State was doing this. Like I didn't have TCU going wire to wire and a questionable call away from beating Arizona. And that's what makes March so special. That's why I love it. And despite the draft guys that get knocked out that we want to see more of, I'm more the first day I care about my bracket. And by day two, I'm just like, I'm doing this. Let's have anarchy. Let's have like the wildest matchup. I like to have a good name or two for the Final Four, just because that draws more fans, more fanfare, more buzz, more of these like David versus Goliath storylines. But you love the underdogs making their statements here too.
And to piggyback off of your recruiting point, I mean, look, we don't know where Shaheen Holloway is going to end up at the end of this, right? Like, we think we know.
I put some money on where I think he's going to go.
Widely assumed that he will be Seton Hall's next basketball coach, you know, former famous Seton Hall alumnus, obviously. And I'll tell you what, man, like, can you remember a coach in the New York area where you felt like that coach had a chance to kind of run New York City and New Jersey recruiting? Like with the message that he's going to be able to just be able to put out there, all of the notoriety that he's getting right now. I feel like that is a message that is really going to resonate with a lot of kids in that area that are going to want to go play for him.
The recency of it too. And it hits, and you have a job in a great conference and a great school where he already has the roots of like, I played there, but it's less of a sell of like, we'll build it together. He's going to be like, I have built this. And now we have like these extraordinary resources and even more of the layered and years of history of maybe Seton Hall basketball behind him. And you'll be hard pressed to find any people in the New York area that want to like go away from that. A lot of times New York kids just go to other schools. I feel like the options there aren't as plentiful, but why leave now? You can play for a guy that's done it, and he can part of himself and be me, be a star here, come back and you can be a coach and do this too one day.
I think that's dead on. Like, I think it's really, really going to be, look, I mean, recruiting is such a national game now. Like kids will go anywhere. Period. Like it's just a little bit, it's different than like the regional, you know, romantic 1980s old Big East kind of deal. Right. But I don't know if he can get 25% of the kids from New York, he's killing it, you know, like, it's,
yeah. And as long as he sort of fits into and keeps that mentality of the type and style of kid that he recruited, that still has a chip on their shoulder, still feels like they have something to prove, because you see at other places where it just doesn't necessarily translate the same way. Like for Shaka Smart, when he was at Texas, it was like, man, he did it at VCU. What's it going to look at Texas? He got plenty of five-star kids there. It just didn't necessarily work. The messaging isn't the same there as it is now. And Texas Tech was the same way. We talked about this here with Mark Adams, and those guys are like, our coach left us. Like, he went to Texas. We're here to pick up the pieces. And they're like crushing it right now. And they bought into the defense and bought into, even if they're not underdogs, if you're told enough that you are, you start to like believe it and embody it. So that's sort of like the balance that comes with it over time too.
Well, and where I think Shaka Smart made a mistake, and this is not like me bagging on Shaka as a coach, I think he's a really good coach. He did a really, really good job this year with Marquette, and did a really, really good job last year with Texas, to be honest. Like, people forget that team won really the Big 12 tournament.
They lost the first round, but they're really good all year. We're good.
Right. Like, he's done a great job the last 2 years specifically, but I think he got away from what he does best in those early years at Texas. He got away from what his identity was at VCU. I don't see Shaheen Holloway getting away from what he wants his identity to be at Seton Hall, which I think is just such a critical aspect when you're going to build a team. you have to have the identity first and foremost. Like, you just have to know who you are and what you're trying to build, and everything else builds upon that. I don't see Shaheen Holloway losing that identity. And that identity, by the way, is a perfect fit for New York City and the kids he's going to be recruiting.
Yeah, there's it's hard not to like look too far ahead of it too. But you see how you see how it could work. You want to enjoy the moment now, and even for him, I'm sure his agent and the people around him are getting blown up. And I know that's part of the process and doing the media tour, and everybody wants a piece now, and everyone's saying the difference is made in St. Peter's. I hope for their sake they still get to have their moments too, their quiet time away from it, and like soak it in. And not all these moments in life, they don't soak in until 10, 15 years later. They're just living in it, and it'll be something they talk about for the rest of their lives. But I hope just for their sake that it's not complete pandemonium, and they can still focus a bit between lines when they have time together too.
And you know what? I do just want to take a minute here, because we just talked about recruiting for a while with Shaheen Holloway. And I think it's just such a like thing to do, unfortunately, where people will talk about black coaches as recruiters, right? Like, St. Peter's is running fucking incredible offense.
Right now. They're running stuff, man. I mean, we're just talking about what he's going to be able to do in the backyard, but like, they're running sets and spreading guys out and running off screens and fake stuff and one line circling back. Like, I was impressed.
They have been unbelievable. Some of the sets he's drawn up in out of bounds plays, after timeout situations, just the general man to man offense that he's drawing up, and, you know, taking advantage of little, you know, disparities and little problems that he sees. For instance, in that Murray State game, like, they were slicing Murray State in a really, really impressive way. And then defensively, they're absolutely outstanding. I mean, look, when you have Casey Nadefo, like, he's just an absolute monster defensively. This is a guy that was going to get invited to Summer League no matter what, because he's the three-time MAC Defensive Player of the Year and is just like such an outstanding instinctual shot blocker who can move his feet and can move laterally, and is 6'7". Like, he has real concerns. He needs to shoot it. But like, he is really, really stood out for a lot of the NBA people I've talked to. And I just wanted to take a minute to note, like, this is not a situation where we should be talking about Shaheen Holloway as a recruiter. Shaheen Holloway has done a fucking incredible job coaching that basketball team, drawing up plays, setting them up for success on the court with his coaching ability.
Yeah, and it's just it also speaks to the unpredictability of March too, because like I know they got hot late, but they weren't like this team that was 30-3 or whatever. Yeah. They knocked off all these giants. And I had a conversation with a mutual friend / agent the other day, which made a point that I hadn't thought about, is that when you get on the neutral court, right, all these teams, all these lower seed teams, they believe it because they're like, their momentum's up. They didn't lose in the second round of the conference tournament. Like, let's pick ourselves up, figure it out. Like, they've won their conference tournament. They are hyped up. They're ready to go. They've grown up watching March Madness. They know the upset potential that's there. And you run out there and you look up in the stands, there's a lot of Kentucky blue, but the whole place isn't Kentucky blue. And there's some St. Peter's. There's some empty seats because, like, the way the games are staggered, like, somehow it's never full, which I don't get. You hit your first shot or two. You start looking at your bench like, we can do this right now. And then you mix in the New York, New Jersey toughness. You mix in some really good sets and putting the pedal to the metal. And that's the elements of the recipe for an upset. And that's why they've done it twice already.
No, it's dead on. Okay, let's talk about Chet and Jabari. We've gone 20 minutes here. I wanted to lead with him, and we just ended up talking about the NCAA tournament for a while. But like, I was blown away in some respects with Chet this weekend and was underwhelmed in some respects with Chet this weekend. And then Jabari Smith obviously gets knocked out yesterday, going 3-for-16, I think, from the field and not taking a shot from the 15 minute mark down to like the 3 minute mark in that game, if I remember correctly. He went 12 minutes without taking a field goal attempt, in part because Katie Johnson and Wendell Green decided it was Katie Johnson and Wendell Green time.
Great time to do it.
which happens from time to time with Auburn, unfortunately, and it was not the best time to do it. I just want to say too, it was clear that Miami heard what Zepp Jasper said when he was asked in, I think it was like before the tournament or before their game, Miami's the best transition team in the country. Like, I know that you guys pride yourself on transition player or whatever. Like, how are you going to win that battle? And he was just like, we're the best transition team in the country. Like, he like laughed it off and was like, they're from the ACC. We are in the SEC. And it was just like, okay, man.
Yeah. Like, well, maybe old Zepp didn't understand that, like, how old that team is. Like, Charlie Moore is like a 12th year senior. He's been at four colleges. Like, that team is old.
And the two oldest teams, I think, in the tournament were Richmond, who won their first round game against Iowa. Their average age is 23.
And Jacob Gilliard and Grant Golden are like 60 year seniors. More power to them.
And then Miami's is like 22.8 or something like that, like 22.9. It's insane. They're so old. Like, they're going to dictate tempo. You have to like play their game basically because they know how to play at their pace.
Yeah, and that's when sometimes the age disparity comes into play, when Jabari Smith's 18 years old and you're getting boxed out by a guy that's 24, and you go to the NBA, you don't have a choice of, I'm sorry, I'm 18, I can only play 18, 21-year-olds. That's what he's going to have to face anyway. Yeah. But they grind you out, man. And like, once they got in that hole and you saw it, it was 7, it was 10, it was 12. Right. And I looked over and I was to my wife, I said, I don't think this is changing. Like, I don't see them hacking away at this, especially when they went away from getting Jabari the ball too.
Yeah, no. As soon as Katie Johnson and Wendell Green started to take over, like, there was a possession where I felt like Wendell Green, like, got a steal. Someone in Auburn got a steal and outletted it to Wendell Green, and Wendell Green just like went and pulled up from three and bricked it. Miami got the rebound. Auburn got like another transition steal and headmanned it to Wendell Green or something. And Wendell Green like went up for some wild layup that he had absolutely no chance to make. And I think that was with like 10 minutes left in the game. I was like, this isn't going to happen. Like, this is just not going to happen if this continues down this road. Like, they need Jabari to be Jabari. And I don't even think it's Jabari's fault that like he wasn't even allowed to be Jabari in that game.
We smelt this out for a while, and I watched Auburn play plenty of times. I watched him in person, and I think we talked about it here. It's just difficult when you have two guards that are so similar stylistically between Katie Johnson and Wendell Green that it's not – you just don't have the steadying hand all the time. Like, end of the shot clock, I don't trust they're going to pull out, run a set. It's like, here comes another wild one. And then when Jabari gets it, and I'll give him a little bit of credit here, or I guess benefit of the doubt, yeah, he was 3 for 16, but a lot of times he's like, I got to shoot now. Like, I might not get it back. Like, if some of them were bad shots, and they weren't falling, but for Jabari Smith Jr., he still had 15 rebounds. Like, he still competed. Yeah. He didn't sulk. I'm not, like, off the ledge. He's still going to be one or two for me. And
can you give me your numbers here in terms of just remembering, hey, guys tend not to play well in the final game of their NCAA tournament
run? Yeah, Kay Cunningham was 6 for 20. I think he had still had 24 points. Franz Wagner was 1 for 10. He was bad. Scotty Barnes had 8 points. He was 2 for 8. And my point is that this is one game. And I know that a lot of people are tuning in for the first time. I know, like, a lot of higher-level NBA guys, this is kind of their first time seeing them because they're being told by scouts, and it's like, okay, I'm locked in. You watch that game, it's like, what am I watching? This guy was 3 for 15. He's still 18 years old. We've still seen a lot of his basketball up to this point. I'm not going to go crazy over this, just like I didn't go crazy when he had 30 points. Like, you still have to find some level of it. You can't use this as like the whole point of view of what you view him as a prospect. And the same goes for Chet Holmgren. The same goes for Paul Mancara, for Jaden Ivey. I'm guilty of it a lot, but we got to get out of this like tournament brain of, oh, he was bad. He's a bust. He's just a jump shooter. You know what? He's not going off the bounce. It's not there. A week ago, we were saying he's a surefire first overall pick. So I'm not going to jump off just because he had a poor game. I'm not saying it didn't. It was a bad performance. You wish that he went on a more positive note. He didn't. I still have all the faith in the world he's going to be a fantastic top three pick.
Yeah. Like, I don't see any world where he falls out of the top three. I just absolutely do not. I think he is as good a chance as any player in the draft to go number one overall. I think that the betting odds right now are like he's the favorite at plus 100 and Chet Holmgren second favorite at plus 115. So like it's neck and neck. And it's probably worth transitioning to Chet at this point, because Chet came out against Georgia State, who, by the way, like, not a 16 seed. Let's be very clear about that. That is like a 14 seed. That is a very good team that was better than the Colgate team, I think, that Wisconsin played. And 19 points, 17 rebounds, 7 blocks, 5 assists, was the best player on the court, not just by a little bit. He dominated the game. Like, completely and utterly dominated the game. Now, Georgia State's front court was compromised. Eliel Sosemi, how do we say his name? How do we say my man's name?
Better than me.
I believe it's Eliel Sosemi, who is their center. He was one of the best defensive players in the Sun Belt this year. He gets hurt like 8 minutes into the game and compromises their depth in the front court. And as soon as that happened, Gonzaga, I felt good that Gonzaga was going to win. I didn't know if they would cover or not, just because, you know, that they were coming from a pretty real tight game in that first half.
Yeah, it's tied. But was it tied at half or down two, up two? It was a 2-point swing, whatever it was.
Something like that. But you could see it coming. You could just see the onslaught that was going to come in the second half. And we saw it again in the Memphis game. And the Memphis game was probably the most interesting evaluation context that we've gotten for any prospect this year, point blank. Chet Holmgren against Gonzaga, or Chet Holmgren against Memphis, I'm sorry. That is because not only does Memphis have Jalen Duren and DeAndre Williams. DeAndre Williams is a 25-year-old dude who is 6'9", 235 pounds or whatever. Jalen Duren is obviously 6'11", 7'5", wingspan, 250 pounds, enormous human being. Memphis has real depth in the front court. Matthew Penny's child, Josh Minot, is there.
If you could play.
Malcolm Dandridge.
Yes. Yes.
Is there. Like, they have real depth of athletes there. You know, maybe Malcolm Dandridge was a little bit tired and was not like the most athletic person on the court, but like, most teams don't have Malcolm Dandridge as your fourth big, right?
Which he had to play too, because those guys got into foul trouble. And this was like, honestly, and this is not a shot at him, it reminded me of men's league when you're supposed to have 7 guys and 5 show up. And like, you're just playing. Mm-hmm. After a while, it's like, dude, I am beat. Like, can we please get a sub? Like, no, dude, there's no subs. Like, you got to go like the whole time. And they're trying to run. They're trying to spread them out. They're pulling them out a little bit. And Memphis doesn't have an option because they get into foul trouble. All those guys are like 4 fouls. So like, he had to play those minutes.
No, that's dead on. And I know that there was a lot of like consternation about Gonzaga and fouls and how Memphis had like 6 fouls before Gonzaga had any fouls in that half. In the second half, that is. I kind of thought that it was fine. Like, I thought that Memphis and their bigs were not moving their feet. And I thought that they were like actually just making physical contact. Like, Chet Holmgren's really good at going up vertically and going backwards while staying as big as possible. Yeah.
Like, and a not fouling. Like,
Yeah, he's just so big. And I think that there was some real, like, people got frustrated by the foul count. I kind of thought Gonzaga took it to them and forced that foul trouble. Like, the one where Jalen Duren picked up his 4th foul on Drew Timmy, where Drew Timmy got the ball, I think it was in the right corner, and then drove.
Yeah.
I mean, Jalen Duren just didn't move his feet. He tried to use his body to, like, push into him to slow him down. And it's just a very obvious foul. Like, I thought a lot of what Memphis got called for in that game were very obvious fouls. And I thought that Gonzaga's footwork in general, from Drew Timmy to Chet Holmgren to Andrew Nembhard, I thought that those guys were just like, they forced the fouls onto Memphis in that game. Like, I get it that people see the foul disparity, but I thought it was fine. Like, I thought it was okay.
I thought it was okay too. And this was the first game because I had someone ask me, what's the prospect matchup you're looking forward to most in the first round? And I didn't really have one. I said David Roddy in Colorado State against Michigan. And I'm just like, fingers crossed, hoping for Gonzaga Memphis. And then in terms of like the individual matchup, it felt like, to me anyway, one of those big time pay-per-view heavyweight boxing matches that doesn't start till 11 o'clock at night. and you're just like waiting all day for it to come. Like it felt like there was enormity of the matchup there. And I knew the files would be an issue. And I wanted Mark Emmert to turn a little bit into Vince McMahon and come down and be like, this game is going to allow six fouls for Chet Holmgren and Jalen Duren. And the crowd goes nuts because you knew they're going to have a happy whistle. It wasn't going to be a situation where these guys are going to play the whole time. And they came out so fast and so hard that Chet and Jalen were gassed at the 16-minute mark for the timeout.
Yeah.
Jalen Duren scores in the first play or buries him, whatever. He points the bench like, I'm that guy. And Chet comes down. They came out way too hot. And you
in the first half, you mean?
The first play of the game, they came out. Like, this is insanity. Like, this pace will not continue of how they're going at each other. And I saw the critiques on Twitter of Chet and Jalen. And the best part is that it was on, like, the same play. Like Chet won versus Jalen won. So in my head, I'm thinking, do you remember the meme a few years ago? Is this dress black and blue or is it white and gold? And people were just so set on. No, it's white and gold. No, it's black and blue. The play with Chet when he gets back down and bodied and then still blocks the shot. There's some people saying Jalen Duren is too big, too strong. Chet can't stop him. Then other people saying Jalen Duren has no craft outside of 2 feet. That's all I can do. Then the other side of the coin. Chet Holmgren can't hold his ground. How's he ever going to be able to do it in the NBA? Other side, he didn't hold his ground, but he altered and blocked the shot. So it's really like beauty is in the eye of the beholder. You could take out of that what you wanted. I wasn't as concerned with the Chet thing. He didn't play well overall offensively to show the whole package this game. He short-armed a couple threes. He was kind of like this scalable, high-level garbage guy by the basket. I don't mean that as a shot either. But it's like, here's a tip dunk. Here's a lob of the dunker spot. Here's getting to the free throw line. He still had 9 points, 9 rebounds, 4 blocks, was in foul trouble, should have had a couple more free throws, should have hit a three. So I was encouraged that if he's able to still do this, he was plowed over and he held his ground, that there's more to come and more to get there. The one thing that concerned me the most is when he put the ball on the floor and he got a forearm into his chest, it looked like slow motion. And the guys in the NBA are more built like Jalen Duren than they are the guys in Georgia State and the West Coast Conference. Still both both great teams, great programs, but Jalen Duren is what they look like. Those are the guys going to face in the front court. So how's Chet going to be able to adjust when he pulls those guys on the perimeter to be able to get by them quickly and not like pushed off? Every time he caught it, it was like a push off. He's off his spot. It's starting as a fadeaway. He's going to have to build his base to get there. I'm still firmly believe he's going to get there. Just going to take some time.
You know, I had no problems with Chet on defense in that game. I thought that the conversation that was happening online that was like, oh, you see this Chet Holmgren, he can't handle the physicality. He and Andrew Nembhard were the only two that handled it in the first half. Like, he got displaced, but he competed every single time. Like, he played 9 minutes in that first half. He competed, or I can't remember. It might have been 11. It was either 9 or 11. Like, he contested every single shot. His ability in drop coverage to just be in the right position all the time was absolutely elite. Like, there, he was rotationally aware the entire time. If you look at the numbers in terms of how Gonzaga's defense succeeded or failed when Chet Holmgren's on the court, Have I shown you these numbers yet? Have you seen them?
I don't know if you had or you tweeted. I think I saw something similar, but I don't know if you showed it to me directly.
So Chet Holmgren played 52 possessions in that game because he played most of the second half and missed, I think it was like 17 possessions in that game. And in the 51 possessions. In the 51 possessions he played in that game, Memphis scored 52 points. It was like 1.02 points per possession. Mm-hmm. How many points do you think Memphis scored in the 17 possessions he was off the court?
Oh, it was 1 point something. So is it, I don't say double, but 1.75?
Yeah, it was a 1.52 point per possession mark. They scored 26 points in 17 possessions when Chet Holmgren was off the court. And you could see why. They just pummeled Gonzaga onto the interior
as soon as they pulled them too. As soon as they pulled them, which is a good coaching move by Penny Hardaway too.
You could see the difference immediately. I thought Chet Holmgren was outstanding defensively in that game. Like, wasn't just good, wasn't just okay. He was outstanding. His defense in that game, it's not the biggest reason Gonzaga won that game. The biggest reason Gonzaga won that game, number one for me, is Andrew Nembhard. He played 40 minutes in a game that you and I were talking about just a second ago. How do they play at this pace the whole game? How do they like not get tired? How do they not get like just worn down? He played 40 minutes in that game, didn't come out for a second, never looked tired, never looked flustered, never looked out of breath even a little bit, and controlled and dictated the tempo of that game. It's such an elite level. Andrew Nembhard's the reason they won that game.
And hit daggers, dagger jumpers.
And hit daggers.
Every time it started to be like building a little and you felt it, here comes a three by Andrew Nembhard. And then credit where it's due. Halftime, whatever expletive laced pep talk Drew Timmy gave, Minister of Culture for Gonzaga basketball. He did a good job like talking through it after the game in PG-ish terms. He was fantastic. He was. I mean, he legitimately could not miss, and he put them on his back for a while too. And that took some of the pressure off of Chet, because early Memphis clogged the lane, so they're trying to go high low. It's like Chet was trying to pass it. He's like, I physically can't do this. The window is too short. So when he got going, and then he's going at the mid post, it opened up so much more space and room in the lane for everything else to happen.
Yeah, I thought it was absolutely really, really impressive, and I thought Chet played an integral role. The thing that you said about his game off the bounce, that's what scared me the most. They ran a couple of slip plays late where he was running a 1-5 ball screen with Andrew Nembhard, where he would come up, he'd slip the screen and pop out to the wing and catch. And it was either a catch to shoot or a catch to drive. And both times they closed out relatively hard and he was able to catch to drive. And they just had no problem recovering. They had absolutely no problem recovering, and they forced him into like a reverse pivot escape pass both times. And it was just like, this is a problem. Like, this is an actual problem. I think
that has to be the sell too, because we're saying, is he a four? Is he a five? Whatever he is, he needs to be able to have that exploit on the perimeter when he has the ball that he's going to get by him. Because if it's just get overly physical and really crowd his space, he turns his back, he kind of fades back a little bit. He can't do that. You can do that if you're hitting threes, but I think he got in his own head a little bit too. He's like 1-for-14 on his last threes. He's made like 1-3 in the last four games.
And he's missing free throws too in that
game. Yeah, front end, 1-1, some free throws. Yeah. I think it was like a technical foul he shot or intentional foul. It was the hook and hold. He shot and missed that one. That's a guy who hits transition threes. It's been weird statistically for him, where non-conference it was like 30-ish percent. And then in conference, like, whoa, this guy's like 48% from three. And now we're back down to he's a shade under 40%. He's like 38.9% or something like that. But he doesn't seem as confident in his shot. And that's something he needs in that toolbox, where his frame and his size is and positionally his right now. He's not going to score in the post. If you're going first overall and a franchise believes in you, you can't just be like a dunker spot fourth guy.
I saw that Ryan Russillo and Bill Simmons brought up the idea that he is hard to evaluate.
Yes. I watched the 3-minute clip.
What do you want to say about it?
The name Sean Bradley was thrown out there, and I was like, I don't know about that.
No, that's not he's not even a little bit of Sean Bradley. But but
they're tough to evaluate because you haven't seen it. Like that's very fair. None of us really have, personally.
I don't even think he's hard to evaluate. I think he's actually a really easy evaluation. It's more you just have no idea how it's going to age, because you have no idea how the frame is going to age. If you would tell me that he's going to get to be 225 pounds, I take him number one and don't even think about it. If he's going to be 210, which by the way would probably be 10 to 15 more pounds, like that's not super ideal to me. And I just don't have like the medical expertise to be able to like tell you how his frame is going to age. I do know he's a hard worker. I know he's incredibly competitive. I genuinely think he's the most competitive player like in this draft class, point blank period. And I'm personally willing to bet on that. But I mean, look, it's not hard to evaluate. It's just a total unknown to me. Like And like, look, I understand that like that's kind of what they're saying to an extent, but the evaluation portion of it, I don't think is that hard because he is so good defensively already. He is a legit shooter. He's a great passer. Everything he does, we just saw how it works when he has to be a part of a team as opposed to being the star. We saw in the first round how it works when he's the star. Like everything here is scalable to be a great high level, like role player, not just like a Sean Bradley level starting center, but being a genuine difference maker, top 10 center in the league. If it doesn't work,
have to believe you do. If the weight doesn't come, he's not a number one pick. And part of me having him number one is I believe it's going to happen. If he doesn't, we'll replay this clip in about 3 years and be like, how'd you miss on Paolo Banchero? He's kind of like the actualized guy. He's what you have now. Just the three had to come around. He's hit some catch and shoot threes in transition. He looks smoother. Like, how'd you miss? It's because you hope that when you draft here, you have a franchise changing guy, but you have to bet a little bit on the upside. You do.
And let's talk about Paolo now before we take a commercial break. I just thought he was outstanding the whole weekend. I thought he was absolutely outstanding. And we've talked about the passing a lot, the two of us on this podcast. He's Duke's best passer. They need to run their offense through him. He is a genuine, like, terrific passer. Over his last 11 games, he's averaging 4.5 assists per game. Like, that's more than Jaden Ivey. I was kind of going through the lottery guys. I think he might be the best passer among all of the lottery picks. Like, it's him and Dyson Daniels.
I was going to say Dyson Daniels. That's the other name that sticks out.
Yeah, but like, he's a better passer than Jaden Ivey. He's definitely a better passer than Jabari Smith. Definitely better than Keegan Murray. Definitely better than Ben Mathurin. Johnny Davis, definitely better than Johnny Davis. Like, you know, maybe Ty. Like, if you have Ty in the lottery, like, I think Banchero is absolutely a terrific passer for his size. Like, you watch him, he just has complete control over the ball. And because of that ability to handle the ball at such a polished level already, he's comfortable throwing live dribble passes off of actions. Like, he's just a very smart, intuitive player.
He was great for Duke late too. And those passes he does have, it's strange because sometimes, and what I've really harped on here, and I have him a spot too low. That's fine. He's going to end up at fourth for me.
I thought you particularly in our group text brought up a really good point with him.
We bring up a lot of points that are good, not good there. So if you could
about like him being like processing the game and like looking like the little pinwheel.
I did say that. I said that when he plays at times, it's just, you know, when you're on a computer and you try to load up a program, like you have it physically, but you get the pinwheel of death and it's just like processing the whole time. You know, it can run the program. It's like, why can't you do this? Like, why are you stuck in that spot? When he catches the ball at the top of the key, sometimes he just does that. He's like, I'm going to dribble. I'm going to mid-range. And once he hits a shot or two, he had two catch and shoot smooth threes where it's like, dude, just do that. You have everything else. He's big and strong. He gets the mid-range. He had that, like, ridiculous Euro step with, like, the wrong foot that he finished down the far end. And like, the passing he has at a high-low when he's double-teamed. The only nitpicky thing I'll say is, like, when the passing starts going, though, he starts doing jump passes, and, like, that's when he gets his turnovers. That's so fixable. That takes 2 seconds. The kid has added to what he's done all season long. I didn't come in, and I saw him plenty in high school. As like a point guard, and that wasn't going to happen. But there's a lot of point 40 stuff that he does.
Yeah. No, I think he is as complete a forward as I've seen in a while offensively entering the NBA. I don't know how high the upside is because his athleticism is not crazy, right? But in terms of being 6'10", having the ability to post, having the ability to play on the wing in legitimate like NBA level sets, where there was that one play where he catches a like escape pass kick out from Trevor Keels on the wing with Mark Williams in the dunker spot on his side of the court in the corner empty. And he like jab steps, shot fakes, drives right because he gets his man off balance. And then Mark Williams' guy has to come and help. I think it was Julius Marble. And he's just dribbling, and then he just whips like a one-handed, right-handed pass to the dunker spot. And it's just like the easiest dunk in the world for Mark Williams. Like, think about the guys that can do that at 6 foot 10, like that are that big and that strong. It's so minimal. It is, especially as teenagers, like it's so, so minimal.
Yeah. I don't know who the answer was, but it wasn't Joey Hauser. He was just like, yeah, this is going to be a long day for you, buddy. He just couldn't stop. Once he got that one jab step and got him rocking, it was curtains. It was all over.
Yeah. No, that was a bad plan. Really excited to see Duke this coming weekend. We're going to talk a little bit about what's coming this weekend at the end of the podcast. But last guy, should we talk a little bit about Jaden Ivey here? Just because he's like the other top prospect that, you know, is in the Sweet 16, right? Like three of our four players got into the Sweet 16. This is great. Like we're really going to get to evaluate guys at a high level. I thought Jaden was fine. He was the guy he's been all year. He had a couple of incredible flash plays and some moments that were just okay.
Yeah, I love the flashes. Don't we all? But once they spread out and kind of went like five out and just let him boogie and like break down his man and step back and give it space, it's like, man, like this is it. Like when he gets the space, the open court, and even the space in the half court, he's a different player. You can tell.
Yeah.
He had one drive. I think it was against Texas and not Yale, where he like went in the lane and he scored like around Zach Edey. Like that guy's just not going to be there next year bumping into him. And that's why I remain so high on him. And I went back and looked through some of these old videos. We talked about this in like November, December of him being a dark horse number one. I could still see a team falling in love and saying like, this is Ja Morant light, Russell Westbrook light, whatever crazy upside-y point guard you could be. And I also found myself going back and watching Ja Morant Murray State tournament clips. Like, what does it look like versus what Jaden Ivey looks like? And Ja Morant was an absolute monster. And stop there with like some of the passing he did. But like in the lane, like a little bit of the craft stuff, I get it. I just think that Jaden Ivey's best basketball still is coming when he has a scheme that's better for him. Put two guys, you texted it, put two shooters in the corner, short roll a guy, hit him. If he helps, the passing is way better too. There were some misses where he beat his man, a guy stepped up, he like whipped it off the baseline. He's seeing the game like a little bit better. The pick and roll stuff's developing. It's not stuck in like second gear like we were March 1st. So I remain a very big fan of Jaden Ivey. It's kind of like net neutral for a stock for me. The great flashes have to do it more. I think he's a little bit of prisoner of what they do there. And I hope we get to see it advance the next round.
Yeah. And like, I like Matt Painter a lot. I think he's great. I'm trying to calibrate what I want to say because I think that
take a 20.
I think his scheme is really like effective, right? For college basketball. It's been proven over the years. They consistently have one of the best offenses in the league, in the country, and they make it work. Right. I'm disappointed on some level that we didn't get this, or we don't get to see Jaden Ivey as often as we could in NBA like setting. I guess. And that's fine. Like Matt Painter should run what he wants to run. He's been as successful as he possibly can be with it. And this is a really good team running Matt Painter's system. Right.
Yeah.
But like they have the personnel to do, they have the personnel to be as elite as any offensive basketball team as I've ever seen. If they would really make it work on the college level, because they have Jaden Ivey, they have Trevion Williams, who you could run 1-5 short roll like actions with, where Trevion Williams is like
throwing over his head anyway. It's like, dude, layup lines, relax, just throw a regular pass.
I mean, like you could run some really high level, high 1-5 ball screen actions with Trevion Williams, and you could use him on duck-ins, and then you have the shooters, like you have Sasha Stefanovic, you have Mason Gillis, you have the other, is it Isaiah or PJ? I think it's Isaiah Thompson. I always forget which Thompson it is at Purdue now. But like you have the personnel you need to run just an unstoppable 1-5 high ball screen action that Jaden Ivey will run mostly in the NBA. And again, like I'm not taking shots at Matt Painter. This is more what I would like to see from an evaluation perspective,
yeah,
as opposed to what works winning basketball games. Right. I'm just disappointed that we don't get to see that as often, from my own selfish perspective, not from like a winning basketball games perspective, which is what he cares about.
And who do they play next round?
St. Peter's.
So I was talking to my friend Zach about this in the office today. What are you going to do? You're going to exploit the size matchup. You have to go to Zach Edey. He's a cheat code in that scenario. So you have to pound the post, get their size or Lechter up in foul trouble. And if they double, then he can hit out and then you go to Travion Williams. So I get it. Now it's really just like the team in front of you for 40 minutes, and then you regroup the next one. He's not going to do anything schematically crazy as far as they've gone now.
Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, let's take a quick commercial break, and we will be back to talk more about the tournament. I have a question to ask you. Let's talk about a different kind of performance than what we're talking about with the NCAA tournament. They want to help your performance in the bedroom. Joy Mode, you know, just like on the basketball court, sometimes you might have an off night. Maybe you're playing okay and you want to take your game up a level even. That's where Joy Mode is going to come in. Don't grab some over-the-counter pills that you see at a gas station. They're going to often contain unregulated chemicals, suggest unsafe doses, carry the risk of several other health problems down the road. That's why we've partnered with Joy Mode. Whether you're looking to spice up your intimate moments or increase your confidence in the bedroom, Joy Mode makes all natural and science-backed supplements dedicated to helping men perform better across their core functions. Their trademark product, the Sexual Performance Booster, is every man's solution for increased performance. It's like a pre-workout, but for sex. And get this, all ingredients have been assessed in peer-reviewed journals and researched in humans. Imagine this, it comes in a palm-sized packet, like your favorite electrolyte powder. Just simply mix it with 6 to 8 ounces of water 45 minutes before sexual activity begins, and you're going to watch the magic unfold. Redefine your intimacy and go to use joymode.com for 20% off with code GAMETHEORY. That's GAMETHEORY. That's 20% off and free shipping with code GAMETHEORY. Not only is this the only supplement you'll need in the bedroom, but it also supports blood vessel support, cardiovascular and heart health, athletic performance, blood pressure, and general erection function. So why settle for anything less? Whether you're happy or unhappy with your performance in the bedroom, why not perform even better with Joy Mode? Okay, we are back. My question for you, Matt Penny, who is the player that helped themselves most in your mind this weekend?
My mind, or just what I think, like the general scouting world's mind? I saw you wrote an article about it. I didn't want to read it because I knew we'd talk about guys helped hurt. Is this just me personally, or what I think is a
let's do both. Consensus? Why not? We have all the time in the world.
We actually do. I have a weird, not weird one, but probably like a non-traditional one. I'm going to go with Mark Williams from Duke. And
he was great. He was great this weekend.
The reason I say this is he had 15 points, 8 rebounds, 5 blocks. And all the stuff we said about Paolo, a lot of it worked because Mark Williams was there to like rip the rim off or then block down the other end and take off. And that coincided with Walker Kessler not playing great. He had 2 points, 2 rebounds. He was 0 for 6 shooting. He wasn't the same player from a month ago where he was named SEC Defensive Player of the Year. I have those guys right here. And it's like, I know it's one game where we're advocating for people not doing this, but I watched that Mark Williams game. I'm like, the translation for him as an NBA 5 is so much more seamless than it is for Walker Kessler. So in my mind, in terms of my draft ranking and evaluating, I took the most out of Mark Williams' positive performance based on the guys that are around him and how he was still effective. And we're not running plays for Mark Williams. He still had 15 points.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think Mark Williams really, really helped himself this weekend. I thought he was outstanding on defense. Two games that don't really put him in difficult positions. Michigan State did run a ton of ball screen actions. Like they probably put him through, I don't know, 60 ball screens, 50 ball screens, it felt like. And I thought he did a really, really good job defending. But between Marcus Bingham, who's just a bit too inconsistent, I think like you're not real worried about Marcus Bingham, even though I thought he played well in that Duke game. And Julius Marble, like you're letting those guys shoot at the end of the
game. Yeah, of course. Of course.
They end up getting free and you're trying to recover out onto them. So I thought it kind of helped him. Plus they don't really have guards that can like truly turn the corner on him essentially and like make his life a bit more difficult. AJ Hoggard can at times, Tyson Walker, not really, but like there's just not really as much concern there. And the good thing for him is, like I said, we're going to talk about these next matchups. Like, I don't think Texas Tech can either. Gonzaga can for sure, but I don't really think Texas Tech is going to present too many problems for him. He's probably the most important player in that game. If he stays out of foul trouble, Duke has a really good chance to win. Yeah, I thought he was outstanding. I thought he was great in both games this weekend.
It's not like he's not in the scouting report, but just an afterthought when we talk about Paul Vaccaro. We talk about what's AJ Griffin doing. Hey, Wendell Moore's figuring out. Like Mark Williams just like does his job. Just runs up and down the court, dunks, block shots. I'll be here when you need me, throw an alley-oop, dunk. Good. That's an NBA five. That's who I want playing the five. And that's why he's like 15 or so on my board now. So in a little bit of a sparring match, throwing back to you, who in your take was the guy or the prospect that helped himself the most opening weekend?
It was Ben Mathurin.
Yeah, I mean that was the answer, but I was trying to go like a little bit hipster here with an offbeat guy.
No, I think Mark Williams did really help himself, so I think that you're dead on. But Ben Mathurin, I mean, oh my God, I don't think I've ever seen him, and this isn't a shot at him. Like I don't mean this negatively, but he was on one against TCU. Like he was more engaged on both ends, just the will to win, the desire, like to put your foot down and say, I am not fucking losing.
Oh yeah. Like, he did that. He did that on both ends and like got to the free throw line. And the best part is he like got three offensive rebounds, just like powered through it. He powered through the trees, got like and ones. I'm like, I don't know if I knew that he had that in him.
I didn't know either. Hand up. I did not know he had that. That was incredible. I thought that his performance against TCU was the performance of the first round. The best I've seen. It was the best I saw anyone play in the first round because of the situation, because Arizona desperately needed him and they needed him right when he stepped up. TCU went on that late 12-0 run to take the lead by, I think, three, if I remember correctly. And they were up 70-67 the first play, run a backdoor for Dalen Terry, or Dalen Terry runs a backdoor for Ben Mathurin.
Spin, bounce pass, yeah.
Yeah, Mathurin catches, goes up, gets fouled, they don't call it, and still finishes the dunk, and he comes up just like that. Yeah.
Well, it did help, though, because the refs let that one go, and then and the regulation, that like turnover E by half court, it was like, maybe some contact there, I don't know. I think because they didn't call that whistle, that one they let slide, even if it wasn't that close, that's why it worked there. But he was I didn't see the 30 ball and the actual winning time moments that he had in him. He also had four assists. He had eight rebounds. So
kind of that's nuts. One thing I wanted to bring up with Ben Mathurin. Do you know how many assists he's averaging over his last 14 games?
I do not.
3.5.
Yeah.
He's really taken a leap as a distributor and as a playmaker for his teammates over the back half of the season. I went back and like actually watched some tape because it's a skill that I think I didn't recognize that he was developing in the back half of that year when I'd watch Arizona. But you go back and you look, you're just like, oh, he's getting into the lane, stopping and assessing now instead of just like stopping and going up for that like little push shot floater off of 2 feet that he has, right? Or like escape passing. Like he's actually attacking to make a play now, as opposed for his teammates or for himself, as opposed to just trying to score himself. That was unbelievable. And then he has the big three where he rejects the Coloco screen, crosses over right to left, and cans a pull up. he had two ridiculous threes off of movement in the first half. And oh, by the way, we haven't even talked about his highlight play yet.
Oh my God.
Like that dunk off the 45 cut from Coloco where he catches the pass and just goes up through Eddie Lankin. Like
that was, I had the TV here, I had the screen there, and I'm kind of like going back and forth. And this game's ending. I'm seeing that. I'm like, oh boy, I better lock in over here. That was ridiculous. That was on par with the Jabari Smith end of the game dunk that he had in the first round, but the Benedict Mathurin one was probably more impactful.
And Isaiah Wong on Jabari Smith. I would say those were the three dunks of the first round.
Yeah.
Man, that was something different from Ben Mathurin. I slid Ben Mathurin up to 8 on my board.
I'm looking at 7 right now, but I've been all over. I had him like 6 when he like ran that like 27 point run for like 4 or 5 straight games. They were getting over the hump. Then it was like, I don't know, it kind of hit the walls. I had him down at like 12, and then I bumped him back up. I did, and this is all still very fluid. While we're talking Arizona, I think we should also probably touch on Christian Coloco a little bit. If he made a draft highlight video, it might just be from that game. The actual highlights of 12 or 13 from the field had some like moves in the post that were a lot smoother than he's done in the past, like two-hand blocking shots. Eddie Lampkin scored on him a little bit, but you see the appeal of, I think I have him at like 40 right now or 41. Is that guy close enough to an NBA 5 that you take him there as opposed to, I don't know, one of these guys of EJ Liddell or Walker Kessler or Mark Williams or even Tari Eason a little bit in the 20s? Like where's your scale on him, and where do you kind of see him fitting right now in the draft range?
Yeah, I mean, he's helped himself for sure. I mean, do you take him or Walker Kessler after the Walker Kessler disappearing act?
Still Walker Kessler for me. I still have him there, but it's starting to make more sense why it could be Christian Coloco.
Yeah, look, I've had Coloco somewhere as a top 40 guy for a while now. I think he goes a little bit higher than where I have him, to be honest. Like, I think he ends up in the end of the first round. It's just like a lot of Clint Capella there. Like, when you watch him,
which is good. Like, if I get Clint Capella at 31, like, I'm doing backflips. That's a home run.
And honestly, if you get Clint Capella at like 17, you're ecstatic.
Yeah, right.
But like, I think there's probably a little bit more downside with Coloco just because he is not quite as fluid. Like, his hands aren't awesome when you watch them. And like, whenever he has to create his own shot out of anything that isn't a dunk, he has these moments where it's just super robotic. And
well, there's some wowzers moments. There is. But he had one turn over his left shoulder where they kind of like snuck in like a ready jump hook and used his length. And that's the intrigue with a guy like him.
But you know what, too? Like, you go and you watch, I don't know how much international stuff you've watched. Have you watched any Ishmael Kamagate?
I had Andrew Schlecht ask me that today. I haven't in probably about 2 months, and that's like the deep dive after the tournament. Like, let me get back into the international prospects.
Kamagate throws up some like wild ones. Like, part of it is because I think he's a little bit more comfortable and a little bit more fluid than Christian putting the ball on the ground.
Yeah.
But like, if you take away his first option, he doesn't see an outlet. Like, he'll throw one at like 100 mile an hour off the backboard.
We saw that pass this weekend. What was it, North Carolina? Who threw the pass that was like,
oh, I know what you're talking about.
Like, fired off the backboard. I just looked. I think it was North Carolina, because I thought
it was North Carolina. No, it was North Carolina.
Because Baycott looked up like, and they showed the replay of Baycott looking up in slow motion like, what is that thing doing?
Like, what are we doing here? I thought it was Mathurin. I thought that Coloco did great. I know you want to talk about Malachi Branham, though.
Oh,
because I thought that he kind of solidified himself in a pretty real way. Like, I talked pre-tournament about these were two really strong opportunities for him, or at least one against Lucas Williamson, to be able to prove that he can be the guy. He actually didn't get much of the Lucas Williamson assignment. They mostly put Williamson on EJ Liddell. I kind of think that was a mistake, to be honest. But what did you think of Malachi Branham in his games against Loyola Chicago and Villanova?
I thought Malachi Branham looked like an NBA player playing a college game. And what I mean by that is, when he actually catches and gets his two dribble pull up and skies and release it, it's just such a smooth jumper. There's like no wasted movement in how he gets it off. He is very stiff. He is very upright. And I just want to like punch him in the legs. So he bends his knees a little bit when he comes off that stuff. And that's why I have just a little bit of hesitation of like how high we move him up, because he doesn't have that burst. But the jumper and the way he was like placing some of his passes to EJ Liddell and coming off ball screens, he is an NBA style game. Just in that a lot of times you see guys going so fast and like so crazy. And as a compliment to him, it's kind of like smarter, not harder. Like he's not like, ah, I gotta go. It's deception of angles and pulling up at like a different time than you would anticipate. But that 23 points on 10 for 19 shooting, 4 assists, they had their back against the wall and he was fine seizing the moment. And he had 2 or 3 rattle out. And I was kind of rooting for them to go down just to see how it went. And he was my friend. And as a Ohio State alum, I think he hit about 2 in a row. And I texted you the Vince Carter, it's over, GIF. I said, I hope you enjoyed his time in Columbus, because this show is going on the road. It is all over for his college days.
Yeah, I mean, just the self-creation pull up. Like, Malachi is what we thought Blake Wesley was early in the year, I think.
So I like that. Yeah.
A lot of the same abilities, same craftiness, you know, same mid-range shooting ability, except I think that Malachi is just a much better shooter right now. Honestly, yeah. I think Blake probably has a little bit more juice off the bounce. Just shiftiness and a little bit more burst probably gives Blake a little bit higher of an upside if it comes together. But I think Malachi's decision-making is a little bit better. He's a much better shooter. He has better balance. Like you say that he's awesome coming balance. Off pretty high on those ball screens. I agree with you. But I actually kind of like the way he comes off of them, because he's always on balance. He's always ready to pull up. He's always got just kind of 2 feet under him in a pretty real way. I don't know what Malachi Branham's going to do. I think he'd go in the top 25 pretty easily. He would have an outside chance at going in the lottery.
We say top 25, you start putting names on the board, and it's like, who's the pairing with him at Combo Guard? Like, who are the names? Like, do you include, I'm just going down the list. All right, Jaden Ivey's going before him. Sure.
Yep.
Johnny Davis, I would take Johnny Davis over him. Okay.
Yeah, we'll talk about Johnny Davis here next, because I want to ask you about him.
Bennick Mathurin, I'm taking over him.
Yep.
AJ's probably more of a wing. I think we said Dyson Daniels. And then it's like, all right, do you want Ty Washington or Malachi Branham?
Yeah. Do you want Ochai Agbaji or Malachi Branham?
That's the next one. Right. So that's when it starts, when you actually put names on paper and you look, and teams are going to say, like, here's our groupings of guys. When you do it that way and not just put, like, here's my top 15, I could see the kid ending up late lottery. I really, really could.
I could, too. Yeah. And look, like, it was funny. Like, someone I believe was his uncle tweeted at me mid-game after I tweeted that I thought he started the Villanova game really poorly.
Yeah.
Because I don't think he was locked in yet. Like, I think that Villanova kind of came out and like punched them in the mouth a little bit.
Oh, they're punchers. I mean, they're death by 1,000 jump stops. Like, you better be ready to play Villanova.
Right. And you better be on your shit. You better be on the scouting. You better be just like fucking ready. And I didn't think Malachi came out well to start. I thought that he missed a few defensive assignments. There was one where he sagged way into the paint and gave up a wide open three. He had a couple of lazy passes early, and Villanova just fucking kills you when you do that stuff. And I thought from like the 5 or 6 minute mark of the first half, after he realized, oh shit, like, this is real now. Like, this team doesn't make mistakes. Like, I have to be ready, and they pounce on every mistake that I make.
Yeah.
I have to be totally fucking locked in mentally. I thought he was outstanding from that moment onward. Like, I thought that he was awesome. I actually even thought he was pretty okay defensively, which is something I rarely say about him.
Yeah.
Having watched a lot of Ohio State games this year, unsurprisingly, like, I actually thought he was kind of a mess defensively, for large swaths of the season. But once he locked in against Villanova, I thought he was really good. I thought he was really, really good, to be honest. I don't really have any complaints. Like, this was a this is a good game for Malachi Branham against Villanova. And I thought he was good against Loyola too. Loyola is another team that punches you right in the mouth defensively. And he had no problem kind of managing that pressure on Ball. Made some tough shots, created some tough shots, was really like Ohio State's only source of offense through large swaths of that game. So, yeah. No, I think he should absolutely test the waters. And I think that would result.
And the feedback's going to be good, too, because he does have a mature, stylish game I think it's better suited for the way NBA teams play, too.
I think I agree. I mentioned Johnny Davis a minute ago.
Yes.
It feels like people are just like killing Johnny Davis right now.
Wild. Yeah.
And it's just like, so like, look, and look, Johnny has said, I'm healthy. I can play. And he's not letting anyone know that he's hurt. And I respect that, like, mentality, but like, he's not healthy. He's not.
No way. 100%. It's, you know what it is? It's like the, I'm going to use Tom Brady analogy because I know you hate it. It's like when the season ends and Tom Brady's like, yeah, actually, like, I have one knee, my ankle is taped together with duct tape. I have bumble gum on my shoulder, and it like comes out. It's not him, but like the team leaks or somebody leaks it. His ankle is not 100%, and he's not going to say that. And he toughed it out. And I also want to say, similar to Ty Washington, where we criticize Ty Washington. I don't think that kid's been the same either since the Auburn game, and he kept tweaking it all year long, and he toughed it out. And for Johnny Davis, when I watched Colgate, my theory was in the first half his ankle was tight, or he didn't trust it, or whatever it was, because when he would have a screen or a ball screen, he would just settle. He wouldn't even like try to get in the lane. He's like, I'm good, coming off jumper, everything was short. And I think when the hourglass started winding down, he's like, oh man, like the season might be over in like 8 minutes. He took over. He had an offensive rerun for a basket. He hit a pull-up. He hit a three. He got him going. He leaked out for a dunk. That's kind of like the guy. And then they dug too deep of a hole against Iowa State, right? Yeah. And there was no coming back. It was an ultimate rock fight, and he was short on everything. You could tell he's favoring it. Even at one point, he's kind of like walking around limping. He's not the type of kid who's going to come out to media and say, hey, I wasn't 100%. I gave it all I had, but sorry, like, we weren't going to win this way. So it's not, I don't think he cares if his draft stock takes a little bit of a dip to say that he left it all out there for a team and a program that supported him and made him player of the year in conference. Like, I don't forget the 25 point games. I don't forget the game they had at Mackey Arena. This is a data point where he wasn't good, but there's plenty of data points on there to say, like, he's going to be a pretty good combo guard in the NBA.
Well, he had no elevation.
None.
He had no elevation comparatively to what he had in the early portion of the season.
Yeah.
Did not have that same stop-start ability, I felt like, kind of being able to stay up on balance for his pull-ups. Did not, like, I just think that turnaround, like, he was able to turn it on for those last, like, 6 minutes against Colgate in that stretch.
Yeah.
But I think that turnaround from Friday to Sunday is quick, and it's probably harder for him to make that turn to that quick turn than anyone else right now because of that ankle. And he tweaked it in the middle of the Iowa State game.
Like, and he tweaked it and Chucky Hepburn went out. So that's a team that doesn't have depth anyway. And I forget who they subbed in. I talked about it today. It's going to kill me. They subbed somebody in, and I don't know, it was Norlander or someone there tweeted, like, I don't think this guy's played all year long, but he's in. It's March. Let's get crazy. And Johnny has to kind of go Captain America, and he's playing a two-man game with his brother in the corner, Jordan. So he's like driving and kicking for threes, and he missed a couple. And the way Wisconsin plays, when you get down, when they're down 7 or 8 and you have like 70% of Johnny Davis, it may as well be like you're down 800 because it's hard to like crawl out of that.
Yeah. Wisconsin at one point put in Isaac Lindsay.
There it is.
Who is a 6'4" sophomore who has played in, it looks like, 4 or 5 games this year, and has not played more than 4 minutes in a game.
And credit to him that he went in there and played. It's just your back is, you don't have many options. And talking Iowa State, one thing I want to say real quickly is when they played LSU, do you know what maddening it must be as the assistant coach that had to scout for that game, where it's like, hey, Tyrese Hunter can't shoot. He shoots 26% from three. Let him shoot. He had seven threes. He was 7 for 11 from three. You know how frustrating it is to prepare for a team and the scout just like throw out the window. And the next game, Tyrese Hunter went 1 for 10. So that like that's the things that will keep you up at night and you think about forever. Like how do we get around this?
And you know what? Like in LSU's case, I don't want to give them a pass because they gave Tyrese some wide open catch and shoot shots too.
But like, don't you do that if the guy shoots 26%? He's like a jet otherwise. Like, all right, just give him space. Like let him do it.
Yes and no. Like, I want to go under screens, but yes. Like, I don't think Tyrese is such a bad shooter in general that, like, I'm not contesting. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not, like, trying to get out. Like, there were times where he was, like, wide fucking open in the corner, and it was just like, you guys can't let him do this. You can't let him keep getting away with this.
Well, he got away with it.
Yeah, no, it's you can't. I just don't. I thought Iowa State did a great job preparing its team, is what I will say this weekend. I thought TJ Otzelberger and that staff did a fucking incredible job. They loaded up the paint every single time LSU drove. They barely defended the three-point line. It was really, really sharp scouting. And then against Wisconsin, you would see, especially when Chucky Hepburn went out, they would overload Johnny Davis's side with help defenders, basically close all of his space to be able to create open shots. And plus, you have Gabe Kalscher, you have the Kuntz guy, Isaiah Brockington, you have Tyrese Hunter's obviously a really good defender as well. Like, you just have all these guys that are really plus defenders that can crawl into a guy's space. Gabe Kalscher did a like lion's share of the job. Did just a phenomenal scout on Wisconsin, I felt, in that game, and deserve a lot of credit. The other game I want to talk about a little bit more substantially is Tennessee-Michigan, because I thought that was a phenomenal game.
Yeah.
And was really interesting from scouting perspective on a number of fronts. Look, Caleb Houston, I think, did he put up a Snell? Was it
a Snell? I don't know if that bad, was it?
It was close, but it wasn't.
Snell-ish. I'll look for it here. I don't know if it was Snell, but it was close.
But it was close. But the guy that was really, really impressive in that game, I thought, was Kennedy Chandler, especially turning the corner. I thought Michigan did a great job late on him. They went some zone looks. They started to kind of differ their ball screen coverages with him. But Kennedy was outstanding for the first 30 minutes of that game. And it was the best I thought I'd seen Kennedy Chandler play all year.
It was. And he kind of ended. He started here. He hit this middle. And I feel like he's done enough to solidify himself as back to being a first round guy, the way that he was able to get in the lane. And they didn't have like ways to stop me either. And he has these weird kind of releases where he doesn't get blocked very often and you think that he would. And the kid, he's won it at every level. You hate to see him go out the way that he did. And you saw the emotional embrace with Juwan Howard, who he's known for forever long as he is. There were pieces that played beyond the narrative. And part of the reason I kind of am slow to push him up another level too is the size, and he hasn't had quite like the struggles with bigger defenders as I anticipated as the year wore on over time.
Yeah, no, he hasn't. I thought he played great. I thought he was a much better defender at the point of attack than what we've seen. Like, he's been really good.
And it's the length too. Like, he's fast and has the length despite being small, so he gets in those passing lanes. You want to cheat like a little bit less, but he has really good instincts to be like one pass away from the ball and like jump that lane.
Yeah, no, I agree.
It wasn't a Snell for Caleb Houston. It was a steal, three rebounds. Snellish. Yeah. That was a good scout.
Two turnovers, too.
Yeah, you know, that does count.
He had one, or no, he took four shots.
No, you know what? We're pod guys here. That would be a trillion. That wouldn't be a Snell. We're not doing that. We're doing trillion for our boys.
We are a trillion podcast.
Yeah, we are a trillion podcast.
We are definitely a trillion podcast. Shout out good friend of the program, Mark Titus. I will say he should go back to school.
Does he though? Like,
yes.
Let's do this exercise real quick. I'm just going to rattle off some names. You say, we're doing a segment here. Should I stay or should I go? Jeremy Sohan.
He should go.
Malachi Branham.
He should at least test and probably end up going.
Bryce McGowan's is gone. He announced that today.
Yes.
Patrick Baldwin Jr.
Test and okay. see how it goes, I think.
Blake Wesley.
I think he should go back.
I do too. And then
it's more because I think his ceiling, if he goes back, works through the decision-making progressions, works through the processing speed of the game, continues to improve his shot. I think his ceiling is going like 7 or 8 next year. I think if he comes out this year, it's probably like 25. And like not a guarantee to go 25, I don't think either.
No. He could slide. You're hoping for a multiple first round pickish type team or like a guarantee at 32 where you say, we'll take you and stash you. But it gets spooky around that range. Like you never know. And the parts I was worried about Blake Wesley, we saw against Rutgers. We saw in the second game where end of the game, he goes left and goes to the rim and gets blocked. And college defenders are great. It's different in the NBA. I admire that he wanted to have that weight on his shoulders, but he didn't quite deliver. The shooting hasn't been as good the last 3-4 games. I agree with that one. Kennedy Chandler, you say go back. And the last one I'll leave you with is
Kennedy Chandler go back to school?
As I would say, you say go back or test?
I would absolutely test, and I think he should probably go pro. I don't know if he should go pro, but like I would venture if he goes pro, he probably goes in the top 35 at the very least. Now
I think top 35 probably
goes in the top 30.
And one other guard who I was very high on who played some point guard, played more point guard due to injury in the tournament here, is JD Davidson.
He should go back.
Yeah. I think we're aligned with those ones.
No, and JD should go back because, again, I think the upside is relatively high if he does not go back.
Right.
If he does go back, I don't know. It's a tricky one. Or if he doesn't go back and goes pro, he's one that could like slide because he is a walking turnover and can't shoot right now.
Oh,
like,
I missed
all the athleticism in the world and like knows how to pass and makes things happen. But the skill level like needs to take a jump. But if it does, his upside is very, very high. So I think I would go back and like take my chances next year, especially playing in that offense where you're probably not going to have Javon Quinterly, I would imagine. I think I saw his brother entered the transfer portal today, which not a good sign if you're keeping Javon Quinterly. Like you're going to have an open runway to just being the lead guard next year. I would go back to Alabama if I was him.
I have one late addition, Kendall Brown from Baylor.
I would go pro, but I think I'm higher on Kendall than most are. I don't know. Look,
were you worried about the North Carolina game though? I mean, he was when they went on that run for the Brady Manek flagrant two, he's out. They went on the run and he was on the bench. Like he didn't play. He played once Flo Thamba fouled out and they needed a body. Does that speak to anything that's their winning time? They're down 20, they tie it or whatever it is. Jeremy Sohan is all over the place defensively.
Unbelievable.
He's guarding RJ Davis and then he's at the top of the press and he's banging a low post with Armando Bacot and Kendall Brown, who at one point we thought was a top 10 guy, isn't even in the game for his team. So if he's not playing for Baylor in crunch time at NCAA tournament, the second round, it would be hard for me to say like, yeah, this is a top 15, top 20 guy.
Yeah, no, it's, he did not help himself late in the season. And it wasn't just that game. It was late in the season. It was the last 15 games that Baylor played. I don't know. Honestly, if I was him, I would test. I would not just full on go. I trust Baylor's developmental staff a lot. I think they're very good. I don't know. I honestly don't know what to do if I was him. I would test, I think, though, and see where it goes.
All right. Everybody's testing. Just take the feedback appropriately and use it as such. Don't go crazy.
I'm trying to think if I have any for you. I mean, Trevor Keels, what do you do with him?
I go back.
I also go back. I agree.
I debated Tre'Quavion Smith. I would test, but go back.
Harrison Ingram.
Tough one. Really, really tough one. He was bad the last month or so of the year.
Yeah.
He ended on a bad note. Test series at. He's a guy that I understand why NBA teams would like the way he passes and sees and his processing of the game, but he shot the ball not great the last stretch there, and he needs that based on the lack of foot speed. He does.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's going to be a weird pre-draft cycle. Like, it's hard. Like, I'm trying to start the NBA draft guide, and I can't quite wrap my head around what the draft pool is going to look like yet. So, like, where am I wasting my time? Where am I not wasting my time?
Do you color code your board? Like, I do. So I have like light blue for guys that may test, and the board just may as well be light blue after about the 10th pick.
No, but I think that's a great idea, and I might do it now.
Good. People helping people. That's it.
Yeah, people helping people.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to talk about looking forward now.
Yeah.
What matchup in the Sweet 16 are you most excited for?
From what perspective, I guess? Like Texas Tech Duke, I'm intrigued by because I think that'll be a chess match because Texas Tech is so tough and they're another team that will punch you in the face. There's some good matchups. Like I really like Gonzaga Arkansas too. Like that's one that we always say like, hey, you got Jalen Williams versus Chip, but they play fast. They scout really well. Yeah. I think that's
probably Stanley Amude versus Chip for what it's worth because they're gonna have to put Jalen Williams on Timmy and try and draw Timmy charges.
This is really corny, but like there's just a lot of games that I like. Like I like Arizona versus Houston. Like that really intrigues me. I like
that'd be my pick.
If Jaime Jaquez is healthy, I love UCLA, North Carolina, just from like here's these old school blue bloods knocking skulls on national TV.
Yeah. Houston, Arizona would be my pick because I want to see these Arizona kids against a better version of TCU. Which just punched them in the face and made them really fight for it.
Yeah.
Like, if they get through that Houston game, I think they're in a really, really good spot. I think they're in a really, really good spot. Here's the thing. Like, all of these Thursday matchups, for instance, it's Houston, Arizona, Texas, Duke, Michigan, Villanova, Arkansas, Gonzaga. Those are incredible games.
Yeah.
They're all amazing. They're all going to be so good to watch. Like, could not be more excited for all of them.
Yeah, it's nuts. We talked about Purdue, St. Peter's. Like, is the magic still there? Is the fairy dust still there? Is the run still going? And I don't want to undersell Iowa State, Miami too. It's kind of a weird, different type of battle, and not like prospecty. But those teams both overperformed what I thought, and especially Houston. I picked UAB. I'll raise my hand. Very wrong there to win and to cover. So double wrong there. I undersold Kelvin Sampson, and that's on me. And he celebrated. He showed the world. Took a shirt off in the locker room. He had a day. And good for him. Deserved it. Earned it.
Well, and I think that, I had Houston in the Sweet 16 just only because of Kelvin Sampson. Kelvin Sampson. That's it. I will say he presents a fascinating test case for Tommy Lloyd as a first-year coach because I think Tommy has been great this year. I think he's been outstanding. I think they run great stuff. Like, consistently, I think they've been really, really good. They run a very competent scheme that works for their personnel. Kelvin's going to make them work for it. Like, he's going to really make them work every single bucket. And how does Tommy adjust to that? How does Ben Mathurin adjust to that? How does Christian Coloco and Ajola Stubelis, who, like, by the way, didn't play a whole lot in that game against TCU, how do they adjust to that? That's a fascinating game to me on a number of like chess move levels. And you know what? Like Iowa State, Miami is probably the game I'm least excited for, but that's a really interesting contrast of styles. Yeah,
it could be the best game. Like I don't, from a analysis standpoint, St. Peter's Purdue doesn't have the same feel as North Carolina, UCLA, but still exciting. Like I'm not going to watch it either.
Yeah, like I'll definitely watch St. Because, like, you know what? The only way that St. Peter's like gets the doors blown off of them is if they're just not big enough to deal with Zach Edey and Trevion Williams. But I think we'll know that pretty quickly.
Oh, first 4 minutes. Oh, the tone will be set.
But if they can deal with that, that's a fascinating game because they have a whole lot of athleticism. Like, I don't know how they guard Zach Edey. Like, that's going to actually just be like, what do they try and do? Like, they probably use the like who what's their starting center's name? He has two first names. Let me look this up. Clarence Rupert is his name.
I was thinking like a repeating name. Like, that's not it.
Yeah, like they played a lot of Clarence Rupert and the Drame guy. They have both of them, don't they? Yeah. But like you probably want to have Ndefo coming over from the weak side to like try and contest that way and just like wreak havoc. How they match up with like Trevion Williams and Zach Edey is fascinating to me. If I was Purdue, I might try to play them both in that game.
I'd rather just not play either of them and just let Ivy go and actually do his thing than to clog it up. Let's unclog it. Let's not throw another big in there. Let's get no bigs. Play five guards. Spread it out.
Oh my God. You're a big. You're 6'8".
No, I'm a perimeter big. I'm a stretch shooter, man. I couldn't move my feet. I couldn't score in the post. I'm shooting pass. Put me on the perimeter.
If you were going into a gym, like if you were to play in a pickup at the Final Four, what are we talking here from three? Are we talking like 5 for 8 from three, like lights out? Like, what are we?
Oh, these days, no. I mean, the men's league peak, yeah, sure. But now we'll be comfortable if it's like 3 for 8 these days.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that.
I'm going to be honest. I'm going to be realistic here.
Division one athlete, Matt Penny.
Yeah.
Like, don't let me forget it.
Somebody from, I did the Down to Dunk podcast today, and they had a question in mailbag. They said, can Matt play 3 10-day contracts so we can like tank more for Oklahoma City? I said, be careful, man. 0.8 points and 0.6 rebounds per game. Might get you a little bump into playing. Who knows?
What would your knees say to that?
They would say no thank you. My bank account would look great. It would be nice for about 3 hours, and then the ice and my back afterwards would not be too favorable, put it that way.
Just be done.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. I don't think we have anything else. I didn't ask for questions this time.
No, it's great. We covered a lot.
I feel like we don't need to dive too deep. I assume there's no chance you watched any movies this weekend, right?
I didn't. I watched Siesta Key is back on MTV, so I watched one just dumb episode to like clear my head. I didn't watch any movies. I have about 3 in the hopper, and I laughed because I think you tweeted about it, but Ben Affleck has a new movie on Apple Plus or Hulu, and
it's like on Hulu. Yeah.
There's snails involved. I actually wanted to see that just based on the preview, and then I want to see the WeWork movie, which I think is also on Apple Plus, with Jared Leto playing the
founder. I believe that's right. I think it's a TV show, isn't it?
Maybe even more so. But I haven't even clicked over there because we've been first four into the tournament from. Legit, I think we recorded Sunday, and then we had like the Monday kind of prepped, and it's been tournament all the way through since then.
Yeah, I have had no time. I worked from 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. Monday through Wednesday, and then Thursday it was, 3 a.m. to 9 p.m. or whatever. So. I've watched one movie in this time. It was The Cursed. Laura and I sat down and watched it.
Here's the clicker. I'm sorry I'm up early. I'm sorry I'm watching these games. You pick it. You drop it.
Definitely a Laura pick. Like, no question, Laura pick. It was Boyd Holbrook and Kelly Riley. It was not awesome. But we have the Nick Cage playing Nick Cage movie coming like within the next month.
So every movie he's made the last 10 years, aside from like Pig.
Oh, well, no. Like, do you not know about this movie?
I don't. I think it missed me.
So it's called The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, where Nicolas Cage is literally playing Nicolas Cage.
I can't. That's off season. That's once you get through the tournament, I don't have to think anymore. That's too much for me, man.
I think that it comes out after the tournament.
Awesome. I'll watch it the Tuesday after the national championship game.
And take a guess what its rating is on Rotten Tomatoes right now.
So Rotten Tomatoes is a percentage, correct?
Yes.
So are we doing audience score or top critics? Very important.
Top critics.
Oh, it's got to be like 26%.
100. We're in triple digits, baby.
How many people? Sorry. That's like out of like three people.
I think it's out of like 17. It's not a ton.
Wow. I'm actually surprised.
But we're ready. We're locked and loaded.
I'm here for a Razzie award-winning movie. I don't know if I'm ready for a Nicolas Cage playing Nicolas Cage being like a best picture. I'm not prepared.
Did you see Pig last year? Because like
no, you said some... that. I didn't. I know that was like kind of his go-to.
Yeah,
his own personal reconnaissance was that.
Yeah, yeah. We're gonna have like a Nick Cage comeback here. The other movie that I'm so fucking excited for, and I hate it. I hate myself for it. Do you know what I'm going to say? We saw trailer after trailer for it during the NCAA tournament.
Corona Light. I don't know. You told me.
The ambulance movie with Jake Gyllenhaal and Yaya.
I made a joke about this to my friends. Like, hasn't he made this movie? Haven't I seen this one like three times? Just like he's been the operator, right? So here's Jake Gyllenhaal's like emergency scene. He's been the operator of that late movie, like the Danish, like Swedish remake, right? He was a Nightcrawler where he's chasing the ambulances and beating them to the crime, and now he's in the ambulance. This is like the trifecta trilogy of Jake Gyllenhaal and 911 operating. Was he just obsessed? He's like, I got to cover this from every angle. I can't do it. I can't.
He's just growing. He's growing.
Yes.
He's getting promoted.
I love Jake Gyllenhaal. I do. I'm a longtime fan, going back to Donnie Darko. But get out of the ambulance, man. Diversify a little bit.
I need this Jake Gyllenhaal ambulance movie. Like, there's no way that this isn't like a dumb rewatchable
good
movie.
Oh yeah, it's the Sunday morning, mid afternoon. Do I take a nap or throw this on? Yes, yeah. Both. Put on the couch. That's the movie. Don't have to think. Pop in and out of scenes.
Yeah. Like, at some point this week, because the Oscars are coming up, I have to watch Drive My Car, which is the 3-hour Japanese movie.
Yeah.
And that's the last one that's on my list, like, period, for all of the Oscars.
That's great. I've
seen everything else. And it's just like, it's 3 hours. It's like a meditation. I'm
literally
just like,
driving a car for 3 hours. It's a lot.
Man. I'm good. Like, I would rather watch Ambulance right now. Like, I get it, but I'm sure it's a great movie. I'd probably rather watch Ambulance if we're just being real about it.
Totally.
Like,
and you're an art house film guy more so than me, but give me the Ambulance. At all the complaining I do, I'll still take the Ambulance. Still chasing.
I agree. But over the next week, I also have to watch as many Nick Cage movies as possible before
we gotta do that every week.
Unbearable weight of massive talent, because man, what a world. Okay, Penny, you had so many great points today on the show that not only is Pete Gillen now alive, he is thriving.
Oh, I love Pete.
And we are.
Pete's the best.
We're ready to go here. Penny, tell the people they can find you on the internet.
Find me on Twitter, Matt_Penny. And here, back here with Sam, the Game Theory Universe, Metaverse, as often as I can, but mostly on Twitter.
So I have no idea when Matt and I will record next. We have to have a conversation about that offline. Because I'm flying to the United States on Tuesday, Monday.
On Tuesday? Time. Wow. We are creeping up. That's a fantastic.
I know, right? Not this week, next week.
Okay. Yeah. No, I know that. But that means that you're getting closer. And hey, man, we might record it like a normal time out of a hotel room. We'll see. We'll see how crazy we can get.
How wild, right?
Yeah.
So we have to figure all that out. I'm going to have a couple of NBA podcasts this week for sure, where I literally just ask the person on the podcast to explain the NBA to me right now, because the NCAA tournament has taken up all of my time over the course of the last 10 days. Keep it locked here, though. We'll have some really, really great content coming up. Until next time, though, we will talk soon. Bye.